Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome to the show. 10 minutes after 9 o'clock, I'm Andy Griffin. Dr. David Blodgett is here. He is the, I always forget your title. He's in charge of the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. There's some kind of fancy name you have, right? Title.
Yeah.
What do they call you? Is it a health officer?
The health officer is the appropriate title. So.
Okay. I'll just call you Dr. Blodgett.
That works just fine. Yeah. Thank you. Just don't call me late for dinner.
Well, that might happen too. I don't know. But thank you for coming in today. A couple of things on my mind I thought worth talking about. First of all, David Heaton was actually on earlier in the show for 5 minutes talking about the measles outbreak in Texas. Unfortunately, one young person, 12-year-old, has passed away unvaccinated. That really brings to the forefront of our minds the whole vaccination thing.
And yeah.
It's frustrating to me. I wrote an article on our website, in basic 890kdxu.com, by the way, to basically saying, look, what's wrong with you people? I mean, we have the certain diseases. I understand, COVID-19. And, some people are like, well, I don't know. And when the mRNA and all this. But we're talking about well-established vaccines that save lives, period. Like the measles vaccine, which is 97% effective, and they're not getting them?
Yeah, measles is the prototype vaccine. It's worked better than any vaccine we have, and it's... we used to have 5,000 deaths a year from measles in this country.
Yeah.
Worldwide, it's still 10, 15% fatal because of nutritional deficiencies and stuff. It's about 1 in 1,000 here in the United States that die from measles, but it's just a risk you don't need to have, and there's these really crazy complications with measles. You get it when you're 6 months old, and then when you're 6, it emerges again, and you get this panencephalitis. It's kind of swelling around your brain, and kids just die randomly, and just crazy stuff. So. And you don't have to worry about that if you're vaccinated. So I don't get it, but I understand we're in an era of, and everything's polarized. Everything has a political tag to it. We can't just
Dr. Blodgett is a lot more tolerant than some of us. I have a couple of friends. They're both they call themselves anti-vaxxers, right? Yeah. They don't believe vaccines. Well. Let me put it this way. They believe vaccines do more harm than good, which, they can give anecdotal evidence of why they believe that way or whatever. But to me, it's like, okay, the risk of whatever it is they say it does to you versus the benefit of whatever we know it does for you, it seems not even close to me.
You look at, there really isn't. I one of the messages I took from COVID, and I already knew this, and we never did this in our district, but everybody wants to blame everything from COVID on public health, and really it was a political and
you did what you were told you had to do,
everything else kind of stuff. And but it always has to be about recommendations and people acting on what they think is right for them, and all I can do is put out good information, make sure people understand, what the risks are. And if people choose not to, I think that's their choice. The problem is nobody really wants the consequences of those choices, right?
Right.
And they're mad.
Right.
So, I get people to call up, this is a terrible disease. I can't believe my kid had to go through it. And I say, you can't have both, right?
Can't. We kind of told you a little bit before, but
it happens with pertussis all the time. There's a reason they call it the 100-day cough, because it just lasts forever. And some of these kids will go through 3 courses of antibiotics trying to get rid of it or come back, or they get it a second time and in a season. And I got to tell you, the risk profile for antibiotics is much higher than the risk profile, whatever risk you might think there are associated with vaccination. So you got this kind of 1 in a million tag of something difficulty happening with vaccination. And we all make decisions based on things like that. In Utah, you know, you can exempt your kids out of getting immunized to go to school and all that stuff. There's no force going on here. It's just, there is this consequence that is you're not vaccinated and you can spread that. And so there is what can happen to you, and then there's also what you can do to somebody else by spreading it to somebody else. And I don't think people think about that, you know. So we
often have the water guy on. I call him the water czar, Zach Renstrom on.
Yeah.
But he has made many discourses about the fact that public relations, promoting, for instance, water conservation really makes a big difference. Do you guys find that promoting whatever it is that we need to promote at the time makes a big difference? Does it really help?
We hope so. I mean, that's why we do it. I think a lot of these things don't really make an impact until they click in.
Until you're personal touched,
yeah. Right, you know. And so I think water is something we're all interested in because we know you can't continue to to have a growth like we are without water. And
right.
So I think you reach a point in your life where you realize, oh, man, you know, all those messages about some of these other things make a difference, right?
Yeah.
And you see something hit your family or, you know, that we call them the aha moment where you really realize, hey, they're actually talking about me, you know?
So I remember way back in the 80s, my buddy had a pickup, big old pickup bed, and we would hire ourselves out to help people move. And big old, you know, cabinets and dressers and beds and pianos. And I remember one time somebody said to me, we were going to move something big, and me and my buddy are both big dudes, and I remember somebody said something to me. They said, man, you're going to have a sore back when you're an old man. And well, I'm an old man now, and I do have a sore back. They were right.
Yeah.
And they warned me. They told me, you got to stop lifting that heavy stuff. It's going to kill you later. And maybe not literally kill you, maybe literally kill you later. But the warning
absolutely.
Was there.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, Ben Franklin got it right. First wealth is health. You lose that.
Yeah.
You lose that ability to move.
Absolutely true.
Some of it's out of our control, the genetics of things. But a good chunk of it is in our control. And that's what our current scientific understanding and our ability to kind of apply things that we've learned the hard way in some ways, you know. Two-thirds of men and half of women will have some form of heart disease during their life.
Two-thirds of men.
You know, so
that's a big number.
We talk about things and we get all upset about things that kill, you know, very few.
COVID-19, for instance, yeah.
And yet, we just let heart disease just kind of be, right? We don't pay attention to it.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal. And I don't know. If you want to put things on, this idea of how do we perceive risk and how do we go about dealing with risk in our lives is fascinating to me. And a few basic things. You know, we talk about the big five. We talk about all these things we keep talking about, and it's always boring because nobody wants to hear it. But the reality is those make a big impact on your long-term health and where you're at. So.
I was going to try. There was a story yesterday on the Newswire about the fact that in the next 25 years, so by 2050, more than 50% of the U.S. population will be considered overweight or obese. We're in the 30s right now, but the trend is upward. And so by 2050, according to the Wire, according to news, national news sources, we're going to be fatter.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the current trends hold, that's true. I don't know that the current trends are going to hold, though.
Yeah.
Let me tell you why. One, I think there's greater awareness, and there's this feeling that the younger generations coming up are more health conscious. So we're hoping that makes a difference. Two, we've got this whole new area of drug investigation and stuff that's going on. So Ozempic makes
right
a big
on the
difference,
tip, right?
And it's
right?
just beginning. So I really think that there's going to be, it's not as dire as all that, but, you know, 50% obese. So you're not just talking overweight because we're about two-thirds overweight now.
Yeah,
that's 50% more more than a BMI of 30, which is that would the diabetes, heart disease, cancer, all of it increases once you get into that range, and a third is a lot. That translates into, you know, half or something like that of the healthcare dollar.
Yeah.
And you magnify that. Diabetes alone is predicted to be about 50% of what we're spending now on healthcare costs by the time you get to those kind of numbers. So I'm hoping that's not that prediction doesn't become reality, because that would be difficult to know how to deal with as a society.
So. A couple of other news items from The Wire that I thought I could have you comment on. One of them was about now Sunday morning, 2 a.m., we push our clocks forward, right? It's spring forward. It's a daylight saving time. There's no S on savings, by the way. It's saving time. I got corrected on the air by Rory the other day, our national radio guy. But anyway, apparently there is a significant spike in heart attacks on the Monday after daylight savings time. And it said it's unclear why. I just wondered if you had an opinion on it.
Yeah.
Mess up the rhythm of your sleep or what?
Yeah, so it highlights how important sleep is, right? We've been talking about sleep, and there's another statistic in there that goes along with that. So there is a spike in heart attacks, but there's also a spike in accidents.
Really?
And other things that are clearly sleep related. And so you, I know I've said this probably too many times, but sleep is important, and we don't pay nearly enough attention to it.
Yeah.
And we're paying a price. And this is kind of this experiment we run every year where we end up demonstrating just little minor changes. It seems like an hour shouldn't make that big a difference, but little minor changes in our sleep patterns make a big difference in our long-term health and how we feel about life and, you know, all that. So
now most of us don't have to get up too early on Sunday, the day you do the time change, but, you know, as mentioned, Monday, everybody has to get up and get to work. And if you're used to going to bed at 10:30, just really add that hour. It's 11:30 at that point, at least according to your body, right? That's what it's feeling. And you have to get up at, you know, crazy early. I don't know. It just,
well, it's 9:30, you know, so you lose that hour in the spring.
Spring forward.
So you're cutting your sleep by an hour.
Really. Yeah. And that's not fun.
So, but we all have times where we don't think it's that big a deal to, you know, stay up late, get up early, those kind of things. And here's evidence that even just one day of missing an hour impacts. There's a noticeable enough trend from a public health perspective, from a population perspective, where you can see an increase in heart attacks, accidents, and, you know, calls to the psychiatrist for people in mental crisis, you know, those kind of things. So
do you have some maybe tips then as far as trying to deal with daylight saving time and losing an hour of sleep? And I mean, should we be trying to gear up for it by getting a little extra, you know, going to bed at a different time? Or
maybe, you know, maybe give yourself a week or so, maybe now start going to bed a half hour early just to kind of soften that blow.
And are we going to do that? Probably not.
The question is, are you going to do that? I've talked about how I kind of woke up to
no pun intended,
sleep
right?
is. Yeah. And been more intentional about how I sleep. And boy, it's sure made a difference in my life. So.
All right, let's take a phone call. Doug on line one wants to talk about daylight saving time. What's up, Doug? Okay, well, hold on. I got to push the right button. Doug, that was my fault. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, the daylight savings time change. We were just talking about that and the sleep deprivation, et cetera. Just a thought, if the federal government, the ultimate compromise, just move it in between a half hour. Just make it a half hour, and if they could get all the states to go with that and then leave it that way. It's not... Because even myself, I have a God. Would I want it to be daylight saving time or the standard time? Which would I want it to be if it was permanent? Just move it right. Just change it back in the middle of half hour in the middle of them, and just a thought.
Not a bad thought, except that would be very confusing, wouldn't it?
There's some good old-fashioned wisdom, right? That's great.
Well, I realize Arizona and Hawaii, as I've heard, don't move their
time.
They
don't use it. That's right.
So the half hour, I thought, wouldn't work with them. They would have to, I guess, go along with it. So that the whole nation, the U.S., was, you know, just move it a half hour and leave it for everybody. It'd be the ultimate compromise.
I don't know about Arizona. They might do that. But Hawaii, the people in Hawaii march to the beat of a different drummer. They just do. So, thank you, Doug.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Congress, the National Congress, has actually voted to repeal daylight savings. But they didn't put any teeth into it, and so it keeps going. And there's a recognition, I think, nationwide that there's a health consequence to this. But the other factors contribute to it, right? So, there's marketing from people that are invested. You know, everything has a constituency that
I think all the big business wants daylight saving because then it's lighter later, and people will shop and eat and do whatever it is they do at night.
Yeah,
before it gets dark.
Anytime we start talking about things that impact like school start times and stuff like that, then you get people upset that you know need to drop their kids off in the way. There's just all of these constituencies that come to bear, and it makes it hard to get stuff done.
So I thought this was fascinating. Yesterday, I went on to Gallup, because Gallup always does some pretty cool polls, and they're pretty much one of the most trusted pollsters in the business. And they had a poll on daylight saving time. And so 25 years ago, turn of the century, 2000, 76% of people favored daylight saving time to standard time. Well, now, fast forward to 2025, they just did the poll this week, and they found that actually 50% of the people favor standard time, and only 42%, and then there's like 8% undecided. But people, the pendulum has swung. We actually prefer standard time now. That's surprising to me.
I think most people that say if you're going to pick one or the other, go with standard time.
Okay.
But... you know, it doesn't, it is hard to, when you wake up in the summer and it's been light for 3 hours. And so I don't know what the ultimate resolution will be. So we mentioned Ben Franklin. He was actually the first one to recommend daylight savings.
Really?
Believe
it or not. Old Ben,
huh? Yeah, so many things go back to the founding fathers.
The key and the kite and the lightning didn't electrocute him enough to get that out of his head, huh? I don't know.
Well, there is a certain logic to it that makes sense to try and maximize daylight hours, but there is this transition where we don't deal with it well to anticipate it and have it not impact our sleep. So,
okay, sleep tips? We've gone over these many times before, but maybe just real quick before we go to our weather break here in 2 or 3 minutes. Things to help us sleep better, because there's another story on the wire today about how basically the odds of you getting a good night's sleep when you're over the age of 65 are not good, because you have to get up for, well, we know, various reasons.
Yeah.
Or for me, lately, my knees have been screaming at me in the middle of the night enough to wake me up. So any tips to help us sleep better?
Well, so there's the difference between time in bed and the time you're actually sleeping.
Right.
Right. And
for
so maybe anticipating that a little bit when you're planning how long you're going to try and sleep. And so one of the tricks is to say, you know, I need 7 hours, but I want 8 hours in bed, because probably an hour of that's going to be not meaningful sleep.
Right.
So if you're only in bed 7 hours and you end up with 5.5 or something, that's really a problem.
Yeah.
A good sleep routine turns out to be really critical.
So doing the same thing every
day. Cooling down your room right before you go to bed makes a big difference. But I think the two biggest robbers of sleep that people don't give enough credit to are, one, blue lights. That's your phones, stuff like that, reading your phones before you go to bed. And two, caffeine. Right, we don't give enough credit to what caffeine does.
So number one, my wife was guilty. Number two, I'm guilty. So
caffeine is tremendously disruptive. Its whole purpose is to stop the wind down cycle, to block the effects of adenosine, which is the one that you build up through the day to help you go to sleep when it gets to be that time. And so you're essentially permanently, you know, you're sabotaging yourself if you're drinking caffeine late at night. So fortunately for us, the half-life of caffeine is about 6 hours. And so if you say, it is a long time. So really what you have to say is, I'm not going to drink caffeine after noon or 2 o'clock in the afternoon in order for that amount of caffeine to be back down to where it'll allow you to sleep.
Actually read my mind. I was going to say, so our last cup of either Mountain Dew or coffee or Dr. Pepper or whatever should be early in the day.
No later than about 2 o'clock.
Okay.
So
that's going to be a hard one to follow, Doc. I'm not going to lie.
It only takes like 22 milligrams of caffeine to interrupt your sleep. And so your average Coke is about, that's about a Coke, but actually there's a little bit more in a Coke, but coffee is about 45 milligrams. You get into Monster or some of that stuff, they're in that kind of 100 to 125 milligram kind of things. And so, but that's a 12 ounce Coke, right? So that's you drink a 32 ouncer, you know, that's 60, 70, 80, a lot of caffeine, and you break it down half at a time every 6 hours, and you'll see you've still got quite a bit of caffeine on board if you've had a big soda during the day. So
number one piece of advice for Dr. Blodgett is, if you have to have your caffeine, try to cut it off a lot of hours before you actually want to sleep.
Yeah.
That's good advice.
All of those substances, though, nicotine, marijuana, alcohol, they all block some aspect of sleep and make it so you don't get a good sleep profile. Mm-hmm. So,
all right, I got to get a weather break in. When we come back, I want to talk more about nicotine and some of the upsetting trends in my mind that young people are, setting right now when it comes to nicotine, with Dr. Blodgett here on the Andy Griffin Show. Be right back.
Thank you.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Well, they call it the habit that causes cancer that we could prevent by simply not participating in that habit. And you say, well, wait, that could be anything. That could be eating Twinkies. But I'm talking particularly about using tobacco. We are down to under 11% now of Americans smoke cigarettes. And that's good. I mean, we're trending downward. And that's a good thing, Dr. Blodgett.
Yeah,
but
that is good.
Unfortunately, e-cigarettes are on the rise, especially among young people. Let's see, this is a CDC said 10.1% of all high school students reported current use of tobacco products, and the number one tobacco product of choice for young people is the e-cigarette or the vape. Middle school students still use it, but it's less. About half as many middle school as high school students use it, and I'm guessing there's probably a small percent of even elementary schools that elementary school kids that do it. But what do you think is so attractive to these young people for a vape? Do they believe it's not as harmful? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been part of the advertising, is that
this is better.
There's nothing bad about it.
But they're wrong, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I there's always harms associated with inhaling something into your lungs on a regular basis. As a physician, I think most physicians would say, you know what, if you can transition them from cigarettes to vaping, that's better. But it's not better to vape than do nothing, right? So there's this gradation of risk. And I actually think one of the things I'm most worried about with vapes is they become this perfect vehicle for delivering all kinds of things.
Yeah, not just tobacco.
It's not just tobacco. And I think the data is pretty stable on how many kids are taking up vaping nicotine. But where it's becoming really a problem is the other stuff that's in there, right? Rates of marijuana and stuff like that. And so there's been this fairly successful campaign that says, well, yeah, cigarette smoking, it's bad, but anything else, you know, marijuana, that's fine, right? And the truth is, marijuana
it's not fine.
It's way worse than smoking. But there's been a fairly successful campaign, you know, through in the media and everywhere else to try and lessen what these other kinds of things can be. And so you hear, I mean, the guys in the ear, I'll tell you, crazy stuff ends up in those vape pens, you know, lighter fluid or, you know, whatever, and they're inhaling it. And it, it's really a problem. So you've got this delivery mechanism that isn't just specific for tobacco or a nicotine product. It's, it can be a lot of other things too. And so nicotine itself has health impacts. There's other chemicals in the vape pens, but, there's also this other trend where it becomes easy to and we call nicotine a gateway drug because you're more likely to do other things once you start it, right? So once the vape pen is part of your life, then you're much more likely to proceed to marijuana and much more likely to proceed to harder drugs, things like that. And so all of it is this kind of really complex message right now.
I was looking at the nicotine of choice for young people, e-cigarettes, number one. Cigarettes are not number two, they're number three. Number two are nicotine pouches.
Pouches, yeah.
I'm not even sure what that is or how that works.
Zyn is one of the trade
just
names.
Put it in your mouth?
So you end up, it's kind of taken, the old chew is kind of still around, but this is kind of like the modern version of chew where you stick it in your tongue.
Do you spit like the old smokeless tobacco people use?
It doesn't. I probably, just because it causes a lot of production of saliva and stuff like that. But the old spitting the tobacco on the ground and, you know, gross stuff is kind of eliminated by these tobacco pouches. So they still have the problem of, in order to get a good hit, they put actually fiberglass in those, right? So chew
fiberglass
in it. So what it does is it kind of puts little micro tears in the lining of your cheek and gum.
Oh, wow.
And allows it to absorb more quickly and effectively. And so that's part of the reason, you know, the tobacco or the nicotine itself is carcinogenic, but then you add that portion to it and it really becomes carcinogenic. And so that's why cancer is really prevalent in the mouth and throat for people that chew and use these oral products like that.
So I think the public perception is, okay, smoking probably causes lung cancer and that kind of thing, chewing or whatever, causes maybe lip or jaw or gum cancer. What else, though, does nicotine cause? What other causes of death? It's not just lung cancer.
A third of all heart disease.
Heart disease,
tied
okay.
to tobacco. Cancers of all types, not just lung cancer, are impacted. So you see a 30% increase in all cancer types.
Really? So
smoke.
Breast cancer or colon or
breast,
whatever?
Prostate, colon, all of it. Well, they're specific studies tying specific cancers, and it hasn't been generally established the links between specific some of them, but overall, if you are a smoker or you have tobacco on board, you're 30% more likely to have cancer. Causes low birth weight babies if you're pregnant, and causes health impacts on the unborn, you know, if you're smoking when you're pregnant. And unfortunately, that seems to be the age range where people are smoking.
For sure.
One of the things about neonatal health or unborn baby health is most people don't realize that by the time you know you're pregnant, you've done the damage, right? So the time to be ready for the baby to come is before you get pregnant. Once you actually figure out you're pregnant, you've really done the damage for that kid. It's really unfortunate.
Those formative few weeks right at the beginning are huge.
Absolutely.
I thought this statistic was interesting. In 2 years' time, we went from about 450 vaping products out there to now there are over 2,000 vaping products, so almost five times as many vape products out there as there were just 2 years ago. I know, obviously, popularity, they wouldn't make them if they didn't sell them, right? But, I mean, are there some things we're not even thinking of? Or is there some stuff out there that's like, wow, where did that come from?
Yeah, well, so you know, we've had a big debate in Utah about flavors.
Right,
how they
appeal
to kids, attracting kids. Should they be allowed? And there was a ban on flavors. And now we'll see where that goes. There's a big lawsuit going on about that, whether that's constitutional to do that or not. but again, in the realm of what's allowed to be sold, like on the internet and other places, you know, you can buy vape pens that have about anything in it, and you can't legally sell like actual THC in a vape pen over the internet, but you can sell THC, the A component, the alpha component, or the beta component, which are actually more intoxicating than the just general THC. And so, so you can go online and get all kinds of stuff right now that has far more psychoactive effect and things like that, just freely available. One thing is we just don't do a good job of keeping ahead of this from a law enforcement kind of standpoint as far as what's legal and what's not legal. By the time you finally get it into code that it's not legal, then they're on to the next stuff, right?
Yeah.
And so it makes it really difficult to have a regulatory response to this that makes sense. We need people to understand that turns out that substances that alter your brain are just not good for you, right?
Yeah.
And you want to stay away from it. And things that offer an escape are never an escape, right? They never end up delivering what they promise. They deliver heartache and pain and problems. And there's always health effects that are associated with it later. There is no good drug that delivers on what it promises. It only gives you the negative effects.
I don't know if you remember the song Huey Lewis.
Yeah,
I Want a New Drug, and he was talking about love in the song. But boy, I was a teenager when that came out. My parents were freaking, "What are you listening to? You're talking about drugs!" And I didn't take any mom and dad. I did take the one he wanted, the love drug.
Yeah.
So, all right, another commercial break in, and when we come back, I want to ask about a couple of other methods of delivering tobacco to the body and how bad are they? We'll talk about cigars and pipes after this.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Dr. Blodgett and I were talking about, you know, how we always choose to do things that aren't good for us. And, you know, we got the health department and our moms telling us don't do that, but we do it anyway. We're trying harder not to, but sometimes you just do, and I don't know.
So, it's human nature, I guess.
I wanted to ask you about cigars and pipes. So obviously cigarettes, e-cigarettes are things that are pretty popular. My grandpa used to smoke a cigar, but he would only smoke a cigar twice a week, maybe at nighttime before bed. And I'm just wondering how harmful was that cigar? And I had another relative who smoked a pipe, but only occasionally. Yeah. How harmful are those?
Well, it fits into that conundrum of it's a tobacco product. Most pipe and cigar smokers don't inhale it as deeply as cigarette smokers do. So
they puff on them.
So it's much more likely to be a kind of mouth and throat cancer kind of situation.
So they're still putting themselves at risk.
So there's still definitely a risk associated with that. And you're also, the side stream smoke issue is a problem. So I don't think most people realize this, but the oxidation and the chemical process that smoke goes through when it becomes second stream or side stream smoke actually makes it more toxic than the direct smoke coming off the cigarette or the cigar.
Yeah.
And so when you're puffing that out of the air and other people are inhaling that inflicts that on everybody around.
So if you choose to smoke a pipe or cigar, you're putting your wife or kids or whoever at risk.
It's that second stream smoke as well. So there's the risk to you, but there's also the risk to everybody around you. And so is it a safer alternative to cigarettes? It all fits into that range of, you know, cigarettes, inhaling a lighted product into your mouth, lungs, whatever you're doing, has a risk. Right, that's just the way the game works, and it's really difficult to mitigate the effects of those risks. So,
all right,
I did want to, with just a couple of minutes left, about 7 minutes left, but I did want to ask you about, about, I would say a month, maybe 2 months ago, they came out with a ruling about this red dye. I think it was red dye 5 or was it 40? I don't know, any one of those. And this was something that had been outlawed for use in makeups for 30-something years. And then they finally came out and said, yeah, we don't want you to use it in food either. And my reaction was, maybe overblown a little, but was, wait a minute. It was banned in makeup 30 years ago, but we've been able to eat it this whole time? That seems kind of screwed up to me.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's great evidence that there's a ton of harm from it, other than there are a significant chunk of people that are allergic to it, interestingly enough. And so there's several in our neighborhood that are allergic to red dye. And so I think it's been difficult to find a good red dye, interestingly enough. You hear about in history, they couldn't create blue. Blue is really a hard color to create.
Yeah, okay.
But red, for edible red, for things that are red, has been difficult for the food additive industry to come up with. And so I think that's part of why red dye has, this particular red dye, 36 or whatever it is, has been persistent, is it's difficult to find a substitute for it. I think once people start with the whisper campaign saying, oh, we don't want that, they're pretty responsive to say, well, we'll get something else, but it's been hard to find something.
So. Yeah. Do we take any stock in the fact that a couple of these dyes have been banned in Europe? They will not, you can't find them in, say, Germany or Switzerland or France or wherever, but we allowed them here for a long time. Does that mean anything?
I don't know. There is this classification called grass, generally recognized as safe.
Ah, okay.
And so if the studies are done and they're proven, so in general, if they're shown to be similar to another product or something, you know, they're considered safe until they're not safe, right? And so there's classes, so they know whole classes are not good, right? So you can't just say, well, this is a little bit different than cyanide, right? So
cyanide, you know, it's fine.
But so once a class comes out that's pretty similar, then they'll say, well, probably that's going to be fine. It's in that kind of generally recognized as safe category. Mm-hmm. And then once the studies come out and say, yeah, this is different than we thought it was going to be. But there's like 5,000 chemicals that come out a year that are in some sort of industrial process or in food or whatever. And it's really just impossible to fully vet and test those before they make it out. And then that tends to be, well, there's a test market called a lot of people eating it before they figure out, yeah, this is a
pretty big test market. Yeah. I grew up, and maybe naive, I don't know, but I grew up, I trusted the FDA to make sure that the food I bought at the store was going to be okay. Should we still trust the FDA? Given everything we've learned?
Make me go on.
Loaded question. No.
I think in general they are true to their cause and they try to do the best that they can given the data that they have. I think the reality is the chemistry of the food we eat is becoming more and more complex and more difficult to figure out what exactly that impacts are going to be. I think that's why in general we make certain statements where we kind of know intuitively things. The more natural it is, the better off you're going to be, of thing. The more processed it is, probably the less good it's going to be.
They even have a word for ultra processed.
Ultra processed. Yeah. I don't know that you could feed the world's population without some of that processing, though, right? And so there's these balances that you have to keep in mind. And I think in general for us, you know, for health advice for those of us in this conversation, I think you say, I would like to be doing the basics better, eating a few more fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. you know, cutting back on some of this processed stuff a little bit more. I think that's just good, safe advice.
Go grab yourself a box of cereal and read the ingredient list.
or a box of Oreos, or and you would think, okay, cookies or cereal, it's going to have wheat and flour and you know, eggs and then you start reading all these different things that you can't pronounce, and you go, oh, I guess this is pretty processed and has a lot of chemicals. But you make a good point in the fact that processed foods get a really bad rap, but isn't eating processed foods better than not eating at all, right, for the world's population that is hungry?
Absolutely. And I think we do a poor job of actually figuring out what the risks and harms really are. Studying nutrition is really difficult because people don't have good memories. Just do this little exercise. What did you eat, you know, 2 days ago for lunch exactly? Mm-hmm. And could you recall that and put it on a nutrition survey for somebody asking you questions about what you ate? And so then you try and figure out, well, does something cause cancer? It's really, really hard. Or is this nutrient critical to health or not? You know, those kinds of studies are much harder to do than you would think, just because we don't have good memories, and people just lie too. They don't tell you the truth about what they've been eating.
Or I mean, there's such thing as false memories. You think you did something and you didn't actually do it. I can think of examples in my own life where, wait, that didn't happen? No, it did not. Dang. So.
But I thought it was.
Yeah.
Or I thought I did better last week, or, you know, whatever. So.
I had, by the way, cheese and crackers 2 days ago for lunch. How many, I could not tell you, however. We're almost out of time. Dr. Blodgett, any last words of advice or any calendar things coming up that you need to talk about?
So we talked about daylight savings.
Yeah.
Our latest issue of the magazine, the Emergency Preparedness One, people have been very complimentary about that, and we're grateful for what they've had to say. And I hope people have had a chance to take a look at that. It has a lot of good information on being prepared for what may come, and just thoughts to implement in your life that might make a difference. So hopefully you've had a chance to take a look at it.
Yeah, take a look at it. All right. Thank you, Dr. Blodgett. Always a pleasure to see you.
Great to see you. Thank you.
Be back tomorrow. Mayor Michelle Randall, St. George City, will be joining me here on the Andy Griffin Show. Thanks for listening, everybody.